This is the American Association of Physics Teachers pilot podcasting series.
2009 Winter Meeting, Chicago, Illinois.
Session FA, Orsted Medal Presentation. The History and Fate of the Universe. George F. Smoot III, University of California, Berkeley. Presider, Harvey Leff.
Welcome to the Orsted session, and I apologize to anybody who knows how to really pronounce Orsted, because I suspect I'm saying it wrong, but I cannot change at this point. So I think we still have people dribbling in. But I think we'll have to start. I think that people will probably come in for 5 or 10 minutes. When Hans Christian Ørsted had difficulty finding a teaching position after earning his doctorate, he became a public lecturer. People paid to see and hear this great physics teacher. Later, as a faculty member at the University of Copenhagen, as most of us know, I think, in the room, he discovered that electric currents generate magnetic fields, a discovery that altered the landscape of physics and, of course, physics teaching. The A.P.P. Ørsted Medal recognizes those who have had an outstanding, widespread, and lasting impact on the teaching of physics. Our Ørsted Medalist, George Fitzgerald Smoot III, made measurements that take us back in time nearly 14 billion years. This outstanding work has led to a map of the early universe that shows regions believed to be the primordial seeds of existing galaxies and clusters of galaxies. This has already had, and will continue to have, a widespread and lasting impact on the teaching of physics, which is what the award calls for, as those of you with good memories will remember I said a minute ago. Professor Smoot earned his bachelor's degrees in mathematics and physics in 1966 and a PhD in physics in 1970, all at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He did postdoctoral research at MIT also before moving to Berkeley in 1971. He is now professor of physics at the University of California at Berkeley and research physicist at Berkeley Space Sciences Laboratory and the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And he is a distinguished member of the Planck team. He might mention something about the Planck project in his talk. George Smoot has authored over 200 articles and co-authored the popularized scientific book Wrinkles in Time. Among his many honors, Dr. Smoot was awarded the NASA Medal for Exceptional Scientific Achievement in 1991. The Lawrence Award in 1995, and the Einstein Medal of the Albert Einstein Society in Switzerland in 2003. And in 2006, he shared the Nobel Prize in Physics with John Mather for discovery of the black body form and anisotropy of the cosmic microwave background radiation. I am honored to present George Smoot with AAPT's Ørsted Medal and to introduce his Ørsted lecture, The History and Fate of the Universe. Now, as it turns out, due to technical difficulties, we don't actually have the medal. We have a check, we think, in the envelope. We won't let him open it until afterwards. And we do have a nice plaque, and the medal, he will receive the medal later. So, George, and I keep saying we have to do a height check on our winners from now on.
I'll pocket the check in case it's valid. I was really looking forward to seeing the medal because when I got the Einstein Medal, I got to go to Bern, partly my sense, and for almost all my sense, but it was still worth the trip, and I got a special tour of Einstein House, and in there they have the medal, and his medal is a little tiny medal that he got. And the medal they give now for the Einstein medal is much bigger than the one that Einstein himself got. So I wanted to know what the Hurston prize looked like. So I'm actually going to I have a thing up which is going to be a new wrap I'll use soon. I'm going to give you guys a preview. We're actually having a YouTube contest to combine teaching and research in the standard. But let me get to what I'm hoping to talk about tonight, which is the history and fate of the universe, although those of you that were at the morning session realized that Lawrence Krauss gave a talk which was more than depressing. Because actually, just about any future you can think of the universe or any fate of the universe is dismal to worse. And so I'm going to concentrate more on the story of the creation and development of the universe and a little bit of the history rather than what dismal end is going to come to us all. Right. The best we can all hope for is to live a little longer and more pleasantly. Right. But sometimes you're going to die at some stage. And that's something that's really been difficult to avoid. And the universe has that same problem. I can't spend too long on this because I actually have one joke in this thing that's relevant to physics. And I want to make sure to get to that. Okay. So we do have a poster, which we hope to get in every physics classroom in the country, if not the world, although maybe in different languages, called History of the Universe, where we put this chart and we update this. And for those of you that are familiar with the particle physics chart, this is designed in a similar line, but we don't have quite a standard model yet, although we've made a lot of progress. And we have a website that goes with it, and if you guys want one, it's Prairie Physics Education Project, and I see some of the people from CPAP here, is a place where you can actually get an order of the posters at replacement costs. So the way we keep it going is you buy one, and then when enough have been bought, we buy the next set, and then lots of stuff data. Okay, so here is the two-part slide. We are going to have a Universe Adventure YouTube contest. And we're looking for the best YouTube videos explaining a facet of cosmological physics or physics for the first one, for students and a teacher team. I know there's a lot of high school science teachers here. This is to give you guys a head up and a head start with your students. There is a development site that we never let people know because we let people just go to universe.org. So this will eventually pop up on that fairly soon. But we have a development site where we're developing the thing and testing it out. And on that are the rules for the video contest. And we actually did last summer at our Teachers Academy, which we of course had the students divide up into five different teams and make five videos, and we actually evaluated it. Remember, if you're actually making a video, it's good to spend more than a week making the video, not actually making the video, but planning for the video. People usually put 10 times as much into figuring out how to do the video than they do in actually making the video, and that'll help. And this is the picture of Earth 2. And without the E, just the flash through the O. And in 1820, of course, he made this famous discovery. And one of the guys who runs the operations at Berkeley for electrodynamics asked me for an evaluation. And I told him the day he happens to be here, I told him, Terry, raise your hand somewhere. It's way in the back. I told him, of course, I have to rate the Hurston demo. It's one of the best demos that I did in my class this semester. I taught electromagnetism to almost 200 students last semester, and that demo, of course, is one of the highlights. And as an example of how you can do teaching and research simultaneously. But anyway, so it is an honor to get this prize. And now let's go on about our story. So we're going to do a cosmic scene investigation. I'm going to skip over some of the stuff about look around the room and see what's in the room, and realize if you're a cosmologist, you got to explain everything in the room. And well, we don't explain every detail, but we explain statistically, right, what's in the room. Namely, where did all the atoms in the universe come from, or at least all the atoms in this room came from. We don't care about the individuals, right? It's the content. We're doing coarse graining in this kind of thing, so we'll see that. So we're looking for the relics of creation and the relics of the events that happened since creation the same way people go to the forensic scene and evaluate what happens there. And there's this ghostly fingerprint of the universe, which I hope we'll get back to at the end of the talk. Okay, so it's also interesting to realize that it was exactly 400 years ago this year that Galileo decided we could augment human senses and develop instruments as you point at the sky and begin to learn about what's going on. So we're celebrating the 400th anniversary of technology aiding humans in making observations about the universe. Right? And this telescope is one of his first telescopes. There's actually four that he's known to be made and different places have it. This is not a very impressive telescope. You know, any telescope you buy now or any binoculars you buy are better than this. But with it, he was able to make some incredible discoveries like, you know, the Galilean moons and prove that there are things going around another body rather than the Earth, right? And also the phases of Venus and a number of other things like that that really put us on the road to what I would call the foundations of modern physics and of modern cosmology. And we've just been accelerating the pace over the last 100 years, although we went through some periods where we didn't go very fast. Now things are going very quickly. So you can make better telescopes. This is the Hubble. This is the Hubble Deep Field. And when I was young, we didn't have a picture like this. You know, when I was in high school, there were pictures of individual galaxies, but there were no pictures like this one. This picture is quite noticeable. It's the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, although there's some additional larger and bigger fields. But this is just a long exposure of the Hubble telescope. And what's remarkable about it is you can see four stars in this picture. And those of you that are physics teachers can tell the optics. There are four struts, and you get fourfold or some kind of symmetry like that from diffraction from the point like the stars. And everything else in here is a galaxy. So if you look here, there's a couple thousand galaxies. Everything else in this picture is a galaxy. So this is there. You can't see the stars because of the force of galaxies. And you know, this is a galaxy very much like our own. And you got to wonder, are there people there or beings there that are wondering where the universe came from, or even looking over at us and wondering what's going on over there? But you'll notice some of the galaxies are sort of yellow in color, like the sun. And a lot of them are sort of blue or white. And the interesting thing is the ones that are blue and white tend to be further away than the ones that are yellow. That's on average, that's the case. And that's kind of surprising because we know since 1929 the universe has expanded and the light from more distant objects should be more redshifted. That is, it should be moved from the blue towards the red. And yet the far away galaxies are bluer and whiter than the nearby galaxies. So already you have evidence from just looking with your eyes at the scene that the universe is evolving and changing. And if you look more carefully, you'll see that a lot of these galaxies are smaller and irregular. They eventually merge and form the ellipticals and the spirals and the more modern ones we see today. And so you can just, you know, gather the information. As Yogi Berra would say, you can see a lot by looking. You know, that's the situation. So our primary cosmic scene investigation tool that really makes this possible for us to do this is that the universe is really big, and the speed of light, which is very large, is not very large compared to the size of the universe. So if we're here on the Earth, we look out to the moon, well, light travel time is on the order of 2 seconds. So take a picture of the moon or take a picture of the sun, it's 2 seconds old or 8 minutes old, it's not a big deal. We were impressed by Polaroids when we get a picture of 7 minutes. Now, in digital cameras, it still takes a second or so to get a nice picture. But if you look out, say, the nearest 50 stars and take a picture of them, on average, they're 10 years old. Now that, you know, you wouldn't wait 10 years for your pictures, right? But if you look out for typical stars in our galaxy, it's thousands to hundreds of thousands of years. And if you look at the nearest big galaxy, Andromeda Galaxy, it takes like 2 million years. If you took a picture of the Earth that was 2 million years ago and just delivered today, what would you see? Well, you wouldn't see any evidence of mankind. You wouldn't see any evidence of a lot of things. And if you took a picture that was a billion years ago, you'd see the planet. The continents look all different. So, you know, we're talking about the scales are quite large. So you look at relatively nearby modern galaxies around us, and you're talking scales of hundreds of millions of years to billions of years. And if we look out as far as we can, we look back nearly 14 billion years. That's a time when the universe was roughly 1,000 times smaller than it is now, and therefore 1,000 times hotter, and therefore as hot as the surface of the sun, and it's ionized, and it's like looking to a fog bank, or like looking at the surface of the sun. You can't see inside the sun with light directly. You have to use sound waves that propagate through the sun and come to the surface and we can see the pattern of sound waves and see what's going on inside the sun. And that is the case that we have in the universe, that there are sound waves in the early universe. They can propagate through the plasma. When they get to the surface of the plasma, which is roughly 300,000 years after, 380,000 years after the beginning of the universe, or the beginning of what we call the Big Bang, that those sound waves, then we get an image of them just like we get images of sunspots or sound waves on the surface of the sun, and we can actually see something about what happens in the early universe by looking at the imprint of those sound waves. So that's the trick. So if we were a really good cosmologist, all we do is take samples. We look at a bunch of objects that are a light second away, and a light year away, and a light, you know, a million light years away, and a billion light years away, and, you know, 2 billion, all the way out, and just make up images from these spheres around us, and we have a time sequence of the development of structure in the universe so that we can compare that to our simple models that we'll make of the universe to see whether the universe is following that understanding. And it's the fact that we have the optical delay line of the size of the universe that allows us to get images from any epoch from the very beginning to the present. That's the strategy we're going to use. Okay, so our simplified version of this is we live in a spiral galaxy. We live on a spiral arm of the spiral galaxy about that far out. So we don't live in the downtown. We're not in the center of the solar system. We're not in the center of the galaxy. And our galaxy is not in the center of any major cluster. We're in a little tiny cluster. So Galileo, you know, the Copernican principle is pretty good. And later on we'll see there's other reasons that it's probably even better. And around us are fairly modern galaxies as we go out. If we go out even further, we start to see irregular galaxies that are just forming up. And they're, while they're just early forming, and when they're merging, they go through periods of intense star formation. Some of those stars are very massive and burn very brightly, and that's why they appear in sort of, that's our model we've been able to piece together and so on. So we have this big picture that the Big Bang is on the outside, and we're in the middle, because we're looking out and we're using time, right? So the beginning of the universe is this outer sphere, the beginning of time, and then 380,000 years later, we have this the surface of last scattering, which we've made this picture of with very high resolution, and it's extremely uniform, but you'll see there's variations at a part 100,000 level. And over time, this develops into the first generation of stars and galaxies, and then develops into more mature galaxies until we're galaxies that are present day. And we would think that we're at adolescence, but we're not in the middle age in terms of the way galaxies are going, in terms of our vision of what's happening. So there's a little bit more time left to do things. Although Lawrence would point out, if the universe keeps accelerating its rate of expansion, we're at the peak time for doing cosmology and extragalactic astronomy. Pretty soon we'll be alone. And so the big event in the discovery, there were a lot of big events. There was Einstein special relativity, there was Hubble making the discovery of the expansion of the universe. But the thing that really differentiated between the Lovell model was the 1965 discovery of the cosmic microwave background, which 15 years later turned into a Nobel Prize. These guys, Penzias and Wilson, are a little older in this picture. But that's the antenna they use. That's the receiver house that they're doing. This is roughly 20-something feet across, which is about 7 meters, to give you an idea of what it is. So they're standing up close, so they look big in this picture. And they're older. This is a picture I took of the Penzias and Wilson receiver. It was actually against Bell Labs property. It was built to look at the Telstar satellite, which was the first communication test satellite put up in orbit, to see if you could actually think about sending communication signals to space and back to the ground instead of building cable holes around the universe. And this is the receiver in which they made the discovery. A critical component was they had a wonderful liquid helium load and a switch they could do. And this fit on the back of that huge horn, and they had a switch they could switch between, and they went back here. And they recorded the output on a chart recorder. That's the way things were in the 60s, right? And that was, their competitor was David Wilkinson at Princeton. Well, their feeble, you know, feeble, sticky role in Wilkinson. He continued on, 1967, 1969, he built piece of equipment that wasn't able to have working in Princeton because of the terrible sky conditions, up the White Mountain Range, which are on the California, Nevada, and the rain shadow of the Sierras, which is pretty dry, although this picture is not on the right end. But you can see one horn looks at the sky, one horn looks at the cold load, and there are three different wavelengths here. And when you assemble it, you put screens around to screen against the Earth, because we're looking at a signal which is 3 Kelvin, whereas the ground around us, this room, is full of 300 Kelvin. And so already you're 100 to 1, and as we see when we start looking for the variation, you're 100,000 parts. So you've got to do better than a part in a million in order to even see them. So this is what his equipment looked like during this time period when I was a graduate student. But later on, I started to get into this, and we had to realize to develop a thing we call the differential microwave radiometer in order to be more sensitive, where you have two identical antennas that point at two parts of the sky, and you switch rapidly between them to look for variations in temperature in the sky. And if you want to calibrate it, you put a liquid helium load over one of those, and then you can compare the temperature of the sky to that. So since whether you want an absolute calibration or a map of the difference of the sky, and here's a prototype we made in the lab. Here's the first, we made some other prototypes we tested up in the mountains. This is the first one we did. You have two antennas. This is 1 centimeter wavelength. Those of you that know your optics, this is corrugated to keep the electric field at zero on the edge, so there's no electric current around the outside. That's one of the two solutions that I will show you to controlling where the signal comes to you from. You know, you don't want radiation coming from the Earth coming around just so you have screens, but you still get the fraction of the screens, so you have a secondary effect to control how things come out. So we have two antennas at 1 centimeter, and this is the thing you saw the prototype of at 0.5 centimeter. This monitors the atmosphere. This looks at 1 centimeter, which is an atmospheric window. 0.5 centimeter is about 400 times the signal from the atmosphere. So if you see a signal, you can rule out what's the atmosphere and what's coming from the sky. And then you have this whole thing in a rotating platform because these two antennas might not be identical, so you can interchange them. And you seal it up so that only radiation can come in through the horns or through the windows into the horns. And then you can analyze what's going on. And it's all designed to rotate around. And then we put it on this airplane, which is famous before this time for making flights from Turkey to Scandinavia, taking pictures of the Soviet Union until it had a misfortunate landing. And so there were a lot of things. It was designed to fly higher than it could be shot down, and it did. It did fly at that height in those days. And there's a lot of instrumentation for looking down and taking beautiful pictures, infrared and optical pictures of the ground, and they used that to turn into remote sensing of natural resources like the coastline and forest fires and crops and so forth. But there was one instrument that looked up, and it fit in this place back there. And after we made a series of flights, we made this estimated map of the sky where we saw a signal which varied at 3/1000 of a Kelvin warmer and roughly in the direction of Leo, and varied smoothly to 3/1000 of a part cooler in the opposite direction.
Please speak into the microphone.
Sorry. I'm so used to wandering. I have a 11-year-old wife and wandering around. I have nervous feet. But this was something that we kind of expected might be there, that is this part in 1,000 variation, because we knew that the Earth was orbiting around the galaxy. The only surprise here was this is almost the opposite direction. So it means the whole galaxy is moving. There's a whole long sequence of astronomers saying this couldn't be true, and later they decided it was true. We saw this whole, all the data could be explained very simply. We didn't have that much of the sky covered, very simply by the simple modulation across the sky. And this is just a Doppler effect. The direction you're going, it looks warmer. The direction you're leaving, it's colder. And it varies with a big cosine across the sky. So that was interesting. And we thought, well, it's time to go on and do some more. And so we decided we had to fly higher and be more sensitive. Right? So we decided we'd go to balloons and design an equipment that normally radiation came in from this direction, but you have a big reflecting mirror that rotates around so that radiation came from that direction. And then the whole apparatus would rotate around and make a circle on the sky. And the rotation of the Earth would sweep the circle in the sky across the sky so you can cover a lot of the sky. So that's the basic idea. And in order not to twist up the balloon, you make a ladder, right? Because you have to have something to torque against. Again, physics. We use physics all the time, surprisingly. To do physics research, that's why the discoveries come faster. The more physics you know, the more physics you can use to do more research. And we cooled our receiver to get greater sensitivity, because now we're trying to get down the lower than a part in 1,003 degrees, and the background is 300 degrees. Right? So we're starting to go down in terms of what's going on. We're developing new technologies to measure, new techniques to measure, new ways to process the data, and so forth. And so here's the actual realization, the corrugated horns in here, we switch up to 3 millimeter wavelength. Everything scaled down factor 3 so we can fit it on the balloon. And we have to cool the whole thing. So we made the choice of cooling the antenna. So there's a window here, and the antenna is actually cooled along with the rest of the apparatus. And this is then our ground screen, and there's a chopper wheel, and there's another ground screen around the outside of it. And there's a little device, which you can see here, which we can flip up into place so that we have a calibrated signal so we knew it was working properly at the right amplitude during the flight. And at the same time we're doing this, Wilkinson's group at Princeton. So we were down getting ready for a balloon flight at the same time. There's one facility in Palestine, Texas, where we all were flying from. And so we were in the same building, putting our equipment together. And so Peter Salson was there, and I said, I want your picture standing behind your equipment, because they have the other solution, and you've got your Princeton t-shirt on. He said, oh no, I have to have my jacket on for the picture. I said, nobody's ever going to see this picture. That's not true. Thousands of people have seen this picture now. So, but anyway, this is Peter Salson from Princeton. Their solution is the opposite from ours. Instead of corrugated horns, you flare the metal so that the electric field will separate from the metal. And the way they did it is you just make a conical horn by wrapping it and soldering it. But then this is big, so you can't cool it. You have to make a transition in here to cool your equipment lower down. You have to window in the waveguide. But in order to get the flared horn, it's very simple. You go to the music store, you buy musical instruments, and you cut the bells off, and you clamp them on so you can see the clamps that hold this up in place. And it's very, it's really appropriate, right? To, listening to the music of the sound from the early universe through musical instruments. Right? I mean, it's a little reverse, but it works pretty well. And here's a picture of Peter, and he didn't always wear his jacket. He was Texas, and it's hot. And Dave Wilkinson getting ready for the balloon launch, and you can see their horns in the ground screen. This is the National Center for Atmospheric Research crew putting on the telemetry and the ballast and so forth for the balloon flight. And that's a picture of that particular balloon going up. So there's hydrogen or helium in this case in the balloon, and as it goes up it expands, and this gets to be roughly, in US 100 yards in diameter. Other places it would be 100 meters. And you have the parachute, and then you have the ladder, and they had a slightly longer ladder than the thing is to keep the parachute from twisting up. It's really a portion of your parachute is twisted when you come down. And this, we had 3 balloon flights, and we made this map of the sky, which is actually well described by 2 components, even though we were looking for the third. The 2 components are the warm to cold, the simple cosine of the sky, and noise, just the straight noise of the receiver. So this isn't the fit, this is the data for each pixel in the sky. And you can ask, how come we didn't cover this part? Well, the answer is our balloon gamma, our flights in the southern hemisphere were from Brazil, and our balloon gamma did not separate cleanly. That's the joint cold welded, and even though we think the squib fired, it didn't come apart. And the chase plane that was following it had to land, according to the pilot, had to land to get more fuel. And while it was being fueled, he went into the bar and he came out and it was dark. And our gauntlet drifted off into the somewhere. And it was found sometime later in the jungle by a person who was making his living poaching palm hearts out of killing baby palms so they can get the hearts so you can have it in your salad. And he thought it was an alien, vehicle. So he stayed away for it for a long time, and since nothing happened for a long time, he figured the aliens were dead. And he went and hacked it with his machete to chase some parts into town to sell, and they realized that it was equipment. And the sheriff made him disclose the location, and we got it back, including the data tapes. And so we were able to recover better quality data. Although it had to be specially treated because it had been in the jungle for 18 months. But anyway, so the map looked like this roughly from the preliminary video. This is sort of the final version of the map. And this was interesting because at this point, we had gotten down to the point where we're seeing a part in 1,000 very cleanly, but you subtract a part in 1,000 and an estimate of the noise and see what other fluctuations there are. And we could say there were no fluctuations on the large scale, that is, between the 7 degrees and the 180 degrees, besides the 180 degrees. 7 to 90 degrees that were at the part in 10,000 level. And those of the people that know cosmology know that meant that you couldn't make galaxies from fluctuations in the early universe unless something else had to change. Either the universe had to get older, or if the answer turned out to be we had to have dark matter. So there's more than one reason for dark matter. At the same time, we were measuring the black body form. So this is a picture of White Mountain when it's white. So it turns out every country has White Mountain. So this is the one on the California-Nevada border, very close to where Wilkinson first went in his early days experiment, except his picture didn't have snow in it, but ours did. And so this is an Italian-American group. This is a Giorgio Serrani's group and Marco Bersanelli's group from Milano. They had a 12-centimeter measurement. One antenna looks at the sky, one antenna looks at the reference North Pole, and then we had a liquid helium doer in here. This could flip over and look at that, so we can compare the liquid helium to the sky. And this is Reina Mandelisi's group in Bologna. This is a factor 2 scale down. So 6 centimeter, 3 centimeter, these are from Berkeley, 3 centimeters, 1 centimeter, 3 millimeters, and then a Haverford College group measuring the monitors in the atmosphere. And back here, of interest, these are one of the groves of Bristlecone Pine. This is not the oldest grove, but some of the trees in this grove are between 4,000 and 5,000 years old. They're thought to be the oldest living, you know, things in the site, but they're nothing compared to this. You know, the light barely makes it here from a nearby star, right? So, you know, a galaxy star. And so that's, we built our own railroad line so we could move our equipment back and forth, and a lovely hut to take the idea so we can get out of the cold. And that wasn't enough. So we had to go somewhere else. So we went to the South Pole. Notice there are no mountains and no trees or anything around. Again, the Italian, a reduced form of the Italian American group. And we didn't go to the ceremonial pole. We went to the true geographic pole. And stuck. This is a picture of me. I wanted to make sure you guys know I made it to the South Pole. You can tell it's me. And I didn't have a gray beard then. That's just your breath frosting on whatever. You will notice that it's really, there's a lot of ice there. But it also makes for a really nice horizon. But the South Pole actually wasn't quiet enough for us, so we had to go a kilometer away because there were too many people running tractors and walkie-talkies and stuff. So we built our own site. And it wasn't cold enough either, so we brought a liquid helium door. And we had a big pit. So this is a screen to protect us against the wind and our equipment over here. We have a pit where we actually work on stuff. And we actually picked a nice day where we could take our hats off. Most of us could take our hats off except for Marco. And so this gives you an idea what the horizon and so forth is like. And the only thing you had to do was not have the wind come up and blow white ice in it so you could find your way back because there was nothing. There's no Guy Parkers except for these little sticks we put in the ground, you know, like Hansel and Gretel. And of course, we go there in the austral summer because we're not stupid. We're not smart, but we're not really stupid. You know, not to go there in the wintertime in the South Pole. And so that happens to be December or January. And so you have to take your fellow researchers away from their families. This is not very popular, see. And you have to think what you're going to give people for Christmas presents. So this is an example of how you know, scientific research really works. You have to have a concept. You have to convince your colleagues to do stuff that isn't all and it's not much fun. And you're only as good as the best person. So you had to get, you know, the worst person. You had to get 50 people to lie down and have some redundancy, but give the redundant people something important to do. Like, you know, but not everybody's willing to lay down on 50, you know, minus 50 degree ice while you climb a tower and take a picture. And you'll notice the quality of this S compared to that S. So it really is the teamwork that matters, and that's something you should, you know, think about in a lot of team interviews. Okay. At the same time that was going on, we were measuring the long wavelengths. We're preparing for the Cosmic Background Explorer Satellite, COBE for short. And again, here's the antenna that looks off the sky. There's a matching antenna that looks at internal cold load. You do the difference between the internal and the external, this time through a Michelson polarizing interferometer, so that you can compare the difference across the whole spectrum. And because you want a very large bandwidth, you use a flared horn. And so what you do is you have the sky and the difference to a well-developed internal black body, and you adjust the temperature of that black body until you get as close to a null as you can. And then when you do that, then you have something to simulate the universe, which is an even better black body that you can flip up into place here. this has come to a very fine point. This is designed to be more than 99% black, and likes to take 7 bounces before it can get in or out. And so we know it to be extraordinarily good black body in terms of what's going on. And so here's the theoretical curve for a black body, which would be thermal radiation from the Big Bang. And here are the fire ass error bars with 400 times error bars. So, you know, it's hard to imagine how precise this measurement is, but it's because it's a double null experiment. And so if everything goes to zero, then systematics and gain errors and everything go away. That's the trick to this experiment. And it's a trick to all the CMB experiments. So here is the result of checking for the CMB intensity versus frequency and comparing it to the black body form. So the dotted line is the best fitted black body form, right? Here are our ground-based measurements in green, the Pinches and Wilson's original point in red, some balloon-borne experiments, some of those from the Princeton group taking their receivers and adjusting them from what's going on. Some of the DMR experiments, which I'll tell you about later, which is on COBE. And then 2 Michelson interferometer experiments, the FIRAS experiment in red, it's just almost a perfect line on here. And then about 6 months later, there was the University of British Columbia rocket experiment, which had much more limited time and was somewhat smaller, but also confirmed these observations very precisely. You can see a little bit of the noise from that one showing up there. So overall, essentially 4 decades, we've shown that the cosmic microwave background has the black body form. It really came from the Big Bang. That's part of the mystery. So now we have a tool, right, we can use to make observations with, just like knowing the light came from the sun, you can make images of the sun. We knew this light came from the Big Bang, so we now can make images of the beginning of the universe. We've been doing it all along, but we've been schizophrenic about it. You know, we're testing to see if it's true over here, and on the other hand, we're assuming it's true, making observations, now we don't have to be schizophrenic anymore. So we're up to the 90s now. This is 1991, and this was the concept we had of COBE in the 70s. We had a little bit of a delay. There was the challenges of after, among other things. But we were late in the queue, too, so we had to wait in line behind some people. And then we had to wait in line when NASA decided when they were going to fire rockets again, and so forth. So the idea was there were 2 experiments inside, the spectrum measuring experiment and the Derby experiment, which I'm going to tell you about, which is diffuse infrared background experiment. That's to look at the light from the first generation of stars and galaxies. And the interesting thing there is, it goes to the thing I alluded to before. It tells you every time you burn some hydrogen or helium into a heavy element like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron, the things that you see around this room, you get 1 photon, basically. And so you can just count how many photons you got and have a checksum. It's the row versus column sum to see whether you got the right solution. And the answer is, well, we saw twice as many photons, but it turns out a lot of them were in the infrared, and we think that was because they were absorbed by dust and molecules and they're re-radiated 2 for 1. Kind of a deal you get. And then there's the differential microwave radiator on the outside. So this was our concept when we put the proposals in the late 70s. And it took a while, but we finally got this. Whoops, I went the wrong way here, I doubled these slides, sorry. I think I must have doubled and dragged it. So here's the actual realization. This is what I thought would be the last time I saw COBE. This is preparing for launch. And being that I lived on the West Coast and we were launching from the West Coast, I was called upon to go down and validate that there were no leaks in this screen that was a deployable screen because we were now back on the rocket instead of the shuttle. And so I got a videotape of me spending 2 hours in the dark with a drop light shining the light through this thing. This is the DMRs, right? 1 centimeter wavelength, half centimeter wavelength, half of 3 millimeters, and then 1 on the other side. Various things down. And this one, these were then cooled because we knew we had to be better. And this is a list. Here's another problem I get with physics teachers and students. That is, if you have the thing exposed, if you have the doer exposed to the air or to the outgassing of the satellite, it will condense on the optics, right? Because the optics are 3 Kelvin, right? So you have to have a lid on to make sure that doesn't happen, right? So you leave the lid on for the first week while you're up there, and then you want to blow the lid off. Now, if the orbits were once at the same time at the same place, will they ever be at the same time in the same place again? That's a physics problem, right? The orbits must cross. How do you? What angle do you tip the spacecraft to, and what direction do you blow the lid off to make sure that the orbits don't cross at the same time? would be, you feel really bad if you shoot yourself down. That's a quiz for you, right, to figure out how that goes. So here's the artist's conception of what it should look like in orbit, and I actually get to play it in orbit because it turned out to come over exactly 14 times a day. So it came over exactly the same time every night. It was on the Terminator, it's on the Earth, it was on the orbit where it's going on the day-night line around the Earth. So in the winter, we'd be in the dark on the ground, but it would be in the daylight, and it rotates around like around this axis. The solar cells are that way. But this stuff you saw the actual picture of before glints the sunlight to the ground, and so you see the satellite moving open with it glinting at 1 RPM. It's a pretty noticeable picture, and you know when it comes over, so you can actually see it. Now it's lost a little altitude, and it's dragging a little, so you have to actually look up when it's going to come over. There's sometimes it's visible, sometimes not. It used to be visible all winter. And now here are the maps we made of the sky. Now you can see, again, this is not a fit, this is the actual data, but now in galactic coordinates, the galactic plane is across here with the galactic center here. The spiral arm we're in, that's 90 degrees in that direction. You can see that. And this is 90 degrees in the other direction. So we're in a spiral arm that I showed you before. And if you look along the spiral arm, you see more than you see transverse to the spiral arm, except when you look towards the galactic center. And then you also see the dipole, the cosine, going very smoothly across from there to there. But now we have a lot of sensitivity. So this is a part in 1,000. If you subtract away the best fitted dipole and blow the scale up a factor of 100, so you're at a part in 100,000, you see the galaxy saturating across here. But you see these blue areas together and these red, sort of red and yellow areas together, blue areas together and so forth. That immediately tells you there are fluctuations that you can see that are at least on two physical scales. There has to be at least a long wavelength one that goes down here, and then small fluctuations that go down, the ones that go up, head towards the normal, and you don't notice them. So when you see groups of things together, it means you have at least one long wavelength one and several short wavelength ones together. But if you actually do the analysis, you see there's roughly equal power on every wavelength. Likewise, if you see warm together, this is just with the galaxy cut out, so you can see the most relevant things here. So already from looking at this picture without doing the mathematical analysis, you can tell there are fluctuations on several scales, and they're roughly equal amplitude because the way they cluster together. And so we have a history now, because Penzias Wilson, if they had mapped the whole sky instead of just looking at a few strips, they, with their big antenna and the long wavelength, 7 centimeters, they would have seen the galaxy as a very sharp line across here, because it is a spiral galaxy, it looks like a CD from a great distance. It's a 78 record, but there's nobody old enough to remember what a 78 record is, except in this room.
Right.
and the rest of it is what we would refer to as a uniform, diffuse, you know, universal black background glow, right? But somehow relic radiation or CMB sounds a little better. And then if you... Sorry. It's so much more fun for me to look at it than to stay at the mic. And then if you blow the scale, you subtract away the dipole, the uniform part of the dipole, and blow the scale up a factor of 100,000, you see this map. And then in 2003, WMAP plotted this. It has now secondary, big primary dish antennas that the feed horns look at a secondary and then the primary. So it's the basic same design as COBE, but now with more optics so that you get better angle resolution. You see the galaxy is closer to being a disk. You see the cold spots together, the cold spots together, the cold spots here. You see the same large scale structure, but you see additional small scale structure. And those of you that are really good at Fourier transforms or circle and running transforms will actually see this preferred scale on here. Not by a lot, but a noticeably preferred scale. And we'll come back to that in a second, I hope. And now we're getting ready to launch, and that's what my talk was this morning. Oops, I didn't fix this one. This is supposed to say April 2009. We had a delay. I didn't fix this slide. But. So COBE was launched in 1989, WMAP at the end of 2000, and Planck, we hope, on April 16th, and in 2009. We had a really coarse map. We got a finer map. However, you have to use the longer wavelengths, which give you poor resolution in order to subtract the galaxy. So once you do that, you get a resolution about like that. Planck will have this resolution, and this smudgy stuff is an indication of what the vector, I'm sorry, not the vector, the polarization, which is a headless vector. It's a line, not an arrow. and what sort of level signal it should be for that kind of a map. And we hope to get additional information from the polarization. So we are in the middle of a great discovery area about the very early universe. It's now going on 16 years. So here's the sky at the COBE-DMR resolution with the best estimate of the galaxy removed and slightly smoothed. The contrast doesn't show up as well on that screen as it does on mine. And this is the WMAP, so forth. If COBE had flipped over, it would have made a map of the universe, of the Earth that looked like this, right, in temperature. The land is different temperature than the water and the depth. And if we were able to do the same map in Planck resolution, you'd see this, although this is a geographical map. But you'll notice there's a very, it's hard to tell the difference between these two, but there's some evidence of difference. But between these two maps, it's very clear the physical processes are very different. Geophysical processes have large nonlinearities in them. The nonlinearities, therefore, correlate modes and correlate phases. You can have sharp edges, and you can have correlated features. Whereas this one is essentially a lot of random Gaussian fields of different sizes, almost completely uncorrelated. The correlations in our analysis so far are below, that is, the correlations from one mode to another are below 10 to the minus 3, almost 10 to the minus 4 level. Whereas here, the correlations are very high. You know, if you had this map, say, 100 years ago, you would be a great geologist and geographer, right? Doing plate tectonics would be trivial. It's pretty obvious, right? Something's been going on, right, that spreads the continents apart. And so, you know, if we had this kind of data about the early universe, we'd be great geologists for the early universe. So that's what we're hoping for, to try and look for this. We know that there could easily be some nonlinearity in the universe. Gravity itself is nonlinear. It produces tremendous nonlinearities later in the universe, but in the early universe, it must produce some very small nonlinearities down to 10 to the minus 5 level. So we're trying to get to that level to see what it tells us about gravity itself. Okay, so we have this model of the universe, which on the surface may look a little strange. So we'll get back to the quantum fluctuations from the beginning time. We have this accelerating phase of the universe, which ends and turns into a decelerating phase. And as the universe expands and cools, it eventually gets cool at the surface of the sun, and neutral hydrogen can form, and the light is released to come to it. Then it takes a while, which we refer to as the dark ages, until the first stars turn on.
Right.
It's not completely dark ages. There are the photons coming from the early universe, and there's a little bit of 21 centimeter radiation from hydrogen molecules forming, but otherwise it's pretty dark. And nobody's really seen any radiation in the area except the second order. But the first generation of stars is something we want to study, and we're beginning to do that. And it's right about here that our solar system starts forming. We're latecomers in this kind of thing. But you'll notice these early galaxies of stars, they're evolving till they become the later type galaxies, like the one we live in. Right? And something else weird happens. The universe, instead of slowing down, begins to speed up this thing. So we have this new component, the acceleration of the universe, which we give the handy label dark energy, because otherwise the DOE will pay for part of it. Although we did get called in by Congress to ask how we can tap that energy. You can do the math, it's a little tough. You need solar system size objects to do it. So while we were doing that, our fellows in other places, this is a map of a million galaxies from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So remember that Hubble picture? You can figure out where the stars are and throw them away, look at the galaxies, estimate not only their angle on the sky, which you can measure fairly precisely, but estimate their distance away, and plot that radially from some convenient location, which we'll call the Earth or this galaxy, and just plot them out, and you'll see this distribution. And you'll see the galaxies are not here, you know, on the street. They're not darts thrown at the board, even by a good dart thrower. It's more complicated. And you'll also see there seem to be fewer galaxies out here. That's the limit of the survey, not the limit of the universe. And if you take pictures and the Earth rotates, you get a fan across the sky, and you need to take a lot of pictures in order to cover the whole sky, and they haven't. They've made a lot of fancy. So I'll show you the video they've made. So now you can see, first you'll notice the geometry of the survey. There's four major fans that have been done. And then if you start looking at the galaxies, you'll notice the distribution of galaxies in the sky is far from being uniform and random Gaussian. It's not very nonlinear. So we've taken the early universe, and through some nonlinear process, namely gravity, we believe, we have created a very nonlinear universe in the second time. because this is just our local neighborhood. It's a million galaxies, but it's not very big compared to the universe. And you have this thing that's the Great Wall, right? And it looks like a great line of galaxies. There's millions of galaxies in there, but it's actually a whole wall, which we're able to tell by doing other samples. But you get some idea of the feel for how the galaxies might be distributed out there. Here's another survey. This is mostly European, the 2-degree field of view. Now, we have more data, so when you were flying here, warp factor a million or a billion, something like that. Remember, light takes 2 million years to get between galaxies. Look at them flying by. But some of them you can tell are spirals, and some you can tell the colors. We have big catalogs now that with millions of galaxies, and we know a lot about the galaxies. Now we'll go out and you'll see the geometry of the survey, which is based on the fact that we're not God or physicists, we're astronomers and this kind of thing. We have to wait for the light to get to us, and so we can only see it where we look, right? And whereas if we were really like Einstein and we had clocks and rulers all across the universe, we could get reports in from everybody, but we don't. We're stuck on the Earth and we have to let the photons come to us. So it limits us in a great way. This is the Great Wall showing up again. So one of the things that we want to calculate is how likely is the Great Wall to appear in the universe. So it's pretty unusual. How special is our universe, or how unspecial is it? So let me go on because I want to get to this. So we're doing surveys on a lot of stuff where you look and see where the stars are, where the galaxy density is, and where the X-rays are coming from. And you see plots like that. You can use gravitational lensing, you can use X-ray telescopes, and you can use optical telescopes and then compare and combine this kind of thing. So you start studying what's going on, and you keep seeing the same story that the baryons, that is the ordinary matter, is confined to the dark matter potential. So we need the dark matter for a lot of reasons, so let's do a simulation. This is a simulation from Chicago. This is just a small scale one for you to see it. This is by Andrei Krasov. His name is covered up, unfortunately, by the scaling here. Normally, if I run this, we're going to see the universe go from fairly uniform, although it's relatively late in it, to being sort of clumpy. And just show you the part where it's interesting. You see, first you form these small clumps, and these clumps then have organized themselves into kind of a cosmic web. That is, they're long strings of galaxies. And where strings come together, you get superclusters of galaxies. And where the couple come together, you get a large cluster of galaxies. Where many strings come together, you get a supercluster. But remember, this is just the dark matter. These are just the dark matter particles. This is treated. There's no interaction between the particles except gravity. There's no other kind of stuff. So now I'm going to show you the results. If you see this one more time. But this is a relatively small simulation, but it's very beautifully done. You can see this condensation, and if you keep running it, the galaxies will flow like molasses down the filaments towards the big intersection. But we don't have the billions of years to wait around for that. Okay, so what do we think matter looks like on a large scale? Well, now that we can do simulations, we actually can be physicists and galaxies. So if you do a simulation on a very large scale, it looks pretty uniform, like the carpet here. Uniform on average, right? It's not a regular grid, but it's a sort of a random pattern that on average is the same no matter where you look. Now the universe itself kind of looks like that. As you zoom in, you start seeing this framework, and this framework is defined by the dark matter household element. But we also put in the physics in the simulation, which is the Virgo collaboration that's done this on the Max Planck supercomputer thing. Also, the ordinary matter is in there. The ordinary matter can dissipate because it can interact with light. It can dissipate extra energy and collapse into stars and the galaxies. So the ordinary matter that's formed stars and galaxies shows up in the color of the sun, yellow, right? And so as you zoom in, you see that in the center of these dark matter halos, there are the stars and the galaxies. So here's the zoom in, the godlike zoom in. So this is 1 gigaparsec, which is roughly, this distance across here is roughly 5 billion light years. As you zoom in, you see this filament, this voids, but these filaments, and of course they're going to zoom in on the most spectacular example where a lot of filaments come together. This is a supercluster, has somewhere more than 100,000 galaxies on the scale of a million galaxies. Now we're zooming in and we're only 125 megaparsecs, which is divided by 0.7. And as you zoom in, eventually you'll be able to see two galaxies that are about as far apart as us in Andromeda, because you don't really notice so much when we look back. But if we lived in a downtown instead of in the boonies, we would see galaxies all around us. So So if you look at these two galaxies, they're about as far apart as us in Andromeda. If you lived in here, you would see galaxies everywhere in the sky. It'd be spectacular. You'd be seeing supernovas go off. You'd be seeing all kinds of other gamma ray bursts too, perhaps. It would be a little less hospitable. And I would show you that they fortunately made two nice movies of this kind of thing. But as you zoom out, you get a sort of an idea of what the whole simulation looks like. And it's only 10 million particles, right? It's approximation. So every particle is like 10 to the 6th solar masses. Okay. So here's the fly-through. Remember, the white is the dark matter that you can't see, right? And the yellow is the actual stars or the galaxies. And you see, when you're in the universe, it's much harder to get a picture of what's going on than when you're standing outside the universe looking at it, right? So it's good to be God or the simulator, right? The case might be. But now you can compare your observations of the galaxies and the structures of galaxies and the rotation curves and the virial velocities and clusters and see whether it matches this well or not. And the answer is, as far as we're able to say, which is now to the 2% level, we're getting a very good description. In some places we're at the 1% level. We're getting a pretty good description of what's going on. We're flying around to see one of these intersections. So mostly there's empty space, and then there are these dark matter halos, and then many of the dark matter halos, there are stars. So we have a pretty good validation of the big picture here, and now we're trying to go through really carefully and see how we can, you know, what things we have to have and what things we don't have to have in order to do that. And it's a simple physics problem. If you measure the boundary condition, right, if you measure very precisely the initial conditions or the near initial conditions on a boundary, hyperspace, time and space, and you have the correct laws of physics, you should be able to find the solution. You should be able to calculate what happens after that, because they're second order nonlinear differential equations, whatever it is, you still should be able to solve it and see, as long as, especially since most of it's linear, you can actually reverse it. So I have a joke I was trying to get to. Barely got to it. So this is a joke about a physicist on Valentine's Day. You'll understand why that's relevant today. Okay. So every Friday after work, a physicist goes to the ice cream parlor and sits at the second to last seat and turns to the last seat, which is empty, and asks a girl who isn't there if he can buy her an ice cream cone. Does this sound familiar? So the owner, who is used to the weird university types, right, always shrugs but keeps quiet. But when Valentine's Day comes and the physicist makes a particularly heart-wrenching plea to the empty space, he can't restrain himself. His curiosity gets the better of him. He says, "I apologize for my stupid question, but you surely know there's never a woman on that last stool. Why do you persist in offering ice cream to an empty space?" The physicist replies, "According to quantum physics, empty space is never truly empty. Virtual particles come into existence and vanish all the time. You never know when the proper wave function will form and a girl might suddenly appear there. And you understand, she will be beautiful and wise and really interested in him." Right? That goes without saying. Right? Okay. So the owner raises his eyebrows, because he's still trying to keep his customers, right? And says, "Really? That's really interesting. But couldn't you just ask one of the girls who comes to your Friday if you could buy her a cone? You never know, she might say yes." The physicist laughs and replies, "Yeah, right. How likely is that?" So this is the point. We're not asking for the girl, we're asking for the universe. What we believe, like if you saw that picture, quantum fluctuations at the beginning of what we call the beginning of time turn into the universe. And this picture is a direct image of quantum fluctuations in the early universe. And some of them, the really tiny ones you can't see because the resolution isn't good enough, they're going to become galaxies like our galaxy. So in this picture, our galaxy was once a quantum fluctuation much smaller than an atomic size, very much smaller than atomic size. And it got stretched by the accelerating expansion of inflation, 30 orders of magnitude, and the coasting of the universe until it started taking off again another 30 orders of magnitude, so 60 orders of magnitude. So it went from 10 to the minus 30 centimeters to 10 to the plus 30 centimeters. So no sweat, right? It's a hell of a microscope. It makes things bigger, and then gravity gets to work on it in the meantime and turn it into galaxies and clusters of galaxies and whatever. So it's a really economical picture, right? Because you should have asked the question at the beginning when I showed you that picture with all the galaxies in it. how many galaxies could we see? And the answer is over 100 billion, if we had enough time with the Hubble Space Telescope to go around, or we had minutes, billions of them to take pictures. Why would you make a universe with 100 billion galaxies in it, especially if you're one of these physicists who believes in the anthropic principle of seeing a thing? Clearly one galaxy would be enough for humans, right? Why would you make 100 billion? The answer is, you can't help but make 100 billion if you're going to make the galaxies out of almost nothing, because you're going to start from a quantum mechanically small size, and there's going to be 100 billion fluctuations in that small size. So, and every one of them has a shot to become a galaxy. So it's a pretty cool picture, right? Usually we don't tell people about this because you guys are special. One extra secret to the universe. We're saving this for the next little friend. So this is the picture that we pasted together, and now we're actually trying to study and see if this is truly the correct picture. But something like this has to happen because we have too many pieces, right? It's like the rich man having to go through the eye of a needle to get into heaven. Any theory that Chris Krieger or somebody has of the early universe has to go through the eye of our observations, and they're really tight for the last 14 billion years. What he does in the first fraction of a second, it's got to funnel into our through the eye of our needle. So I wanted to show you another picture. So this is the evolution of a single overdense lump in the early universe, and I can only show you 2 out of 3 dimensions. And so in this 2 out of 3 dimensions, what you see is a Gaussian-shaped lump stays Gaussian, but a part of it goes out spherically in a shell. How could that happen? All right. Well, I don't know. It looks pretty cool on there, right? But how does that happen? Okay. Let's think about it in one dimension. Let's just look at the radial distance and ask what happens. And remember now that the universe is actually made of more than one thing, right? It's got dark matter, it's got ordinary matter, it's got photons, it's got neutrinos, it's got gravity waves. Gravity waves are not interesting, they just flee out, right? So let's see what happens when I start this Gaussian-shaped lump evolving over time. Oops. It was getting just interesting. If I could stop it. Okay, so see what's happened. The dark matter, it has to be cool dark matter, pretty much stays lumped up. There's a little bit of the Maxwell-Boltzmann tail guys that kind of get dragged out, right? They kind of flee out. The photons and the ordinary matter are very tightly coupled because they're ionized, and the photon pressure just pushes it out. So the photons are trying to get out, and just have to drag the baryons and the electrons with it. And the neutrinos almost escape. They have a lot of interactions going on. They almost escape. There'll come a time, roughly twice this age, roughly 380,000 years, or 0.4 mega years, in which the universe gets cold enough, and then there's no photon drag, and those photons come to us. And so you see the spherical shell of matter. You see that image. That's the structure of